hello, podcast friends. This is Ann Althaus, your podcaster, your blogger. It's Monday evening. Getting a late start today. Well, a late start on the podcast. I actually got a pretty late start on the blog, too. The first thing I wrote about this morning was Biden chooses Antony Blinken, defender of global alliances, as Secretary of State. The president-elect is also expected to name Jake Sullivan, another close aide of his, as National Security Advisor, and Linda Thomas Greenfield, a 35-year Foreign Service veteran, as his ambassador to the UN. And that's all in the New York Times. Quote, Mr. Blinken has been at Mr. Biden's side for nearly 20 years, including as his top aide on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee and later as his National Security Advisor when he was vice president. In that role, Mr. Blinken helped develop the American response to political upheaval and instability across the Middle East, with mixed results in Egypt, Iraq, Syria, and Libya. But chief among his new priorities will be to reestablish the United States as a trusted ally that is ready to rejoin global agreements and institutions, including the Paris Climate Accord, the Iran nuclear deal, and the World Health Organization, that were jettisoned by Mr. Trump, close quote. And I said, I'm pleased to see such boring choices. Remember, a couple of weeks ago, the news was that Pete Buttigieg wanted the UN ambassador job. I was sarcastic about that. Of course it makes sense that his background as a mayor of a small city in the Midwest sets him up well to deal with international affairs. In the comments, Rocketeer said, so will I be the first to start referring to the VP, Secretary of State, and POTUS as Winkin, Blinken, and Nod? Meade read that out loud to me, and I immediately recited, Winkin, Blinken, and Nod one night sailed off in a wooden shoe. Sailed on a river of crystal light into a sea of dew. Where are you going, and what do you wish? I couldn't continue verbatim, and I couldn't freestyle rhymes about Biden and Harris, so I'm not bragging about my poetry expertise, just saying I loved those Eugene Field poems when I was a child. I'm just seeing now that Eugene Field's father was the lawyer who represented Dred Scott. His father was, this is a quote from Wikipedia, his father was Roswell Martin Field, an attorney who represented Dred Scott, an African-American man known for the 1857 U.S. Supreme Court case in which he sued for his freedom. Many believe the denial of Scott's bid by the court prompted the U.S. Civil War. And then I wanted to find a YouTube that showed the poem in full, and I was delighted that what I found was an animation, the full text of the poem, in an animation by Disney Studios, set to music and sung by one of my favorite singers, Donovan. So that was quite lovely, a little cheesy, but what are you going to do? It's Disney. It was totally Disney. So that's all very nice. You know, Blinken, we have a Secretary of State that has a somewhat odd name, but don't they all have odd names? Winken. He's winking at us. He knows what he's doing, and he's letting us know, signaling. Anyway, the next post, this is from a column in the New York Times by Ben Smith. Get me Meacham. Biden brings back the media's good old days. The next president promises to do for old line newspaper columnists what Donald Trump did for cable. What a time to be George Will. Okay, so here's a second post, and it seems like there are going to be a lot of posts like this about how sort of dull and boring Biden is, especially in contrast to Trump. It's sort of exciting to be boring now because Trump was so overexciting that Biden can easily distinguish himself just by being sort of a nothing or just a rest period. Anyway, quoting from Ben Smith's piece in the New York Times, now listen closely. Biden spent most of his career as a bit of an outsider to Washington's social world, his face pressed against the glass. The cool kids, including President Barack Obama, occasionally mocked him behind his back for his cornball earnestness. Mr. Trump's obsession with the media took the form of constant obstreperous complaints and news-making leaks a style Mr. Biden has suggested he finds merely embarrassing. Mr. Biden sought their approval with a more diligent and solicitous approach. As vice president, for instance, he was particularly attentive to the wise men of Washington, especially the foreign policy columnists David Ignatius of the Washington Post and Thomas L. Friedman of the Times. Mr. Biden likes nothing more than a wide-ranging, high-minded conversation about world affairs after he had returned from a trip to China or India. It seems that what Donald Trump did for the once dying industry of cable news, Joe Biden may do for the dusty old newspaper column. Mr. Trump has gotten us all used to an extraordinary, if inadvertent, level of transparency. He rarely resisted answering shouted, timely questions, and his leaky White House offered journalists and their audience an X-ray portrait of a government running off the rails. And I said, I've been reading traditional media all along, and I can't stand cable news. I've followed Trump directly, reading his tweets and watching his rallies and press conferences. But will the people who binged on cable news switch back to traditional print media like Newsweek and the New York Times just because Biden isn't keeping cable news fueled with hot tweets and video clips? It's not as though people need to consume news. They can play video games or superhero movies. There's all kinds of fast food for the mind. And if for some reason people want something more sober and intellectual, there are all kinds of heavier TV shows. The Crown! And an endless supply of substantial books. Obama's memoir! We don't need the latest news, especially when it's dull, to be analyzed more deeply or pseudo-deeply. We're free to branch out to more interesting things. And we can still listen to Trump, who's likely to become even funnier and wilder. So, cable news benefited a lot by having Trump as the president. And so there's this idea that if Biden is the president, maybe traditional print media will do better. Because Biden likes to talk to Thomas Friedman. That will make us want to read such things. I mean, we've gotten a taste, not we, but other people. I don't like cable news, but these people who are watching a lot of cable news under Trump, they've got a taste for what they've got. Why would they want to equally keep up with Biden as opposed to just ignoring him? I mean, I think it's going to feel like more of a rest period. And I've been seeing the announcements of who Biden is appointing for this and that. Kerry as the climate czar, Janet Yellen as the Secretary of the Treasury. These are all very, there's something normal about it all, something boring about it all. But doesn't that mean we can go on to something else and not monitor the news? I mean, I think there's a danger of becoming too complacent, of seeing it as a rest period, and maybe they'll do all sorts of bad things because we won't be interested in looking. It won't seem interesting. I mean, if you're really going to do something bad, that would be the way to do it. Make it seem so dull and inconsequential that no one wants to watch, or just play into our weaknesses as Americans wanting always to be entertained. Don't be entertaining, and then we won't watch. We'll look at something else, and then you can do your evil deeds, whatever they are. If you think Biden is up to no good, then maybe you should worry that he's adopting this strategy of being so dull you won't even think of watching him. He's not putting on a show. That's a good way to get your dirty work done. But I'm not saying I think he's going to do any dirty work. I think he really is probably offering us just quiet and a rest period. And obviously, job number one is to deal with the coronavirus. He'll just have to do that one way or another. I see let me switch to this top post. No, wait. Oh, I got a bunch of posts. I better do them in order. I'm going to lose myself, but I'll come back to the subject of the boringness of Obama. The next post is from a column by the law professor, expert Election law expert Rick Hazen, it's in the New York Times, Trump's legal farce is having tragic results. There's nothing funny about the Republican Party's multi-pronged attack on voting rights. And this is just a little quote from that column. A federal district court opinion issued in Pennsylvania Saturday laid bare both the dangerousness and the vacuousness of Mr. Trump's litigation strategy. Rudy Giuliani, acting as one of the president's lawyers, failed to persuade Judge Matthew Brann, an Obama-appointed Federalist Society member and former Republican official, to disenfranchise nearly 7 million Pennsylvania voters and to let the state legislature name a slate of presidential electors. The court held that the Trump campaign offered a Frankenstein's monster of a legal theory and that the complaint was full of nothing more than strained legal arguments without merit and speculative accusations unpled in the operative complaint and unsupported by the evidence. Dilatory tactics like delaying certification or recounts will be rejected by courts or governors, and not even a single state legislature, much less three, seems eager to incur the wrath of the American people through a power grab that would violate the rules of law, trigger massive street protests, and call the legislators' own elections into question. By the time President Biden takes the oath of office, millions of people will wrongly believe that he stole the election. Mr. Trump's false claims will delegitimize a Biden presidency among his supporters. Mr. Trump's litigation strategy also will make things worse when it comes to voting rights. These unsuccessful lawsuits will provide a false narrative to explain how it is that Mr. Biden declared victory and serve as a predicate for new restrictive voting laws in Republican states, close quote. I have a lot of ellipses in there, so there's some jumps that are filled out in the actual original article. I mean, you can see that Trump's effort to attack the results in various states has been a big mess. The evidence has not been shown to us. The courts aren't buying the arguments or the evidence. It's just not good enough, and it's been prolonged to the point now where it's really quite awful for Trump to be doing it. But so he's, you know, that's going to end at some point, and it's not going to get anywhere. Hazen points all of that out. But he's going beyond that and expressing concern that there's still going to be millions of Americans who think that there really was some kind of fraud. They are going to be convinced by Trump, and they are going to think this is all legitimate. And that's going to have an effect on things. That's going to make he predicts. I don't know, what will that effect be? Why wouldn't we say it's a good effect that people will be activated to be hyper-concerned about fraud in voting and that efforts to purify the voting process and make it work precisely accurately will be heightened? But Rick Hazen is afraid that that kind of momentum to work hard on making voting work accurately and correctly will actually produce laws that are about suppressing voting rights. It will keep people from voting. There'll be restrictive voting laws. So Hazen isn't supporting the laws that are designed to protect us against fraud and to preserve democracy. When he thinks about the kind of laws that will be passed, he thinks these aren't laws that are really about getting us that kind of accuracy and precision. These are laws that are about deterring poor people, black people, different kinds of more easily disenfranchised voters to keep them from voting. And that's just the old argument that we saw long before Trump came into power, which is that Republicans were worried about fraud and Democrats were worried about suppressing the turnout, keeping certain voters that are predicted to vote Democrat from voting. So what's really being done? What are the two parties really trying to do? Obviously, the people, the Trump supporters, the people who think there's a fraud, are going to continue the Republican tradition of thinking that what we need is legislation and stronger efforts to protect the vote from fraud. And Democrats are going to continue to say what they were saying long before any of this Trump business got started, which is that Republicans want to deter people from voting and make it hard to vote, that they think they win by suppressing the vote. So that will go on. Will Trump have made that any worse than it was before? Well, Hazen thinks that this feeling that millions of people have that Trump was cheated out of his win will maybe light a fire under Republicans and cause there to be a stronger effort going forward to protect against fraud. And so maybe Hazen needs to stir up fervor on the Democrat side that efforts need to be made to oppose those Republican efforts, and that needs to be done in the name of ensuring that people not be disenfranchised. So it's the same old argument that we've seen for many years. Whether it will be intensified or not, maybe it will. Maybe this experience with the 2020 election will make that all get much more heightened. The next post, finally on a different subject, it's about the brain. It's an article in the New York Times by psychologist and neuroscientist Lisa Feldman Barrett. And the article is called, Your Brain is Not for Thinking. Your brain is not for thinking. In stressful times, this surprising lesson from neuroscience may help to lessen your anxieties. And here's a little quote that I took out. Consider what happens when you're thirsty and drink a glass of water. The water takes about 20 minutes to reach your bloodstream, but you feel less thirsty within mere seconds. What relieves your thirst so quickly? Your brain does. It has learned from past experience that water is a deposit to your body budget that will hydrate you, so your brain quenches your thirst long before the water has any direct effect on your blood. This budgetary account of how the brain works may seem plausible when it comes to your bodily functions. It may seem less natural to view your mental life as a series of deposits and withdrawals. Every thought you have, every feeling of happiness or anger or awe you experience, every kindness you extend, and every insult you bear or sling is part of your brain's calculations as it anticipates and budgets your metabolic needs. Every mental experience has roots in the physical budgeting of your body. This is one reason physical actions like taking a deep breath or getting more sleep can be surprisingly helpful in addressing problems we traditionally view as psychological. If you feel weary from the pandemic and you're battling a lack of motivation, your burden may feel lighter if you understand your discomfort as something physical. Acknowledge what your brain is actually doing and take some comfort from it. Your brain is not for thinking. Everything that it conjures from thoughts to emotions to dreams is in the service of body budgeting. So there's more to it if you read the article. That might be a little hard to understand just from that quote, but it's saying that if you have anxiety or weariness, these psychological conditions, they may be effects of your body, and that you may be able to deal with your seeming mental issues by doing something with your body. What can you do with your body? Well, there's so many things you can do with your body. Instead of trying to figure out your psychological problems, do something with your body. What are the things you can do? Well, number one, sleep. Number two, eat something that's good for you. Don't use the substances that bring you down. Go for a run. You know the many things you can do. Take care of yourself. Why don't you? Now, here's a post about, this is the one I most want to talk about, so I'm going to save that for the end. I'll just say I've got three other posts and then the one I'm saving for the end. There's, that's a good one. Okay. Let's go to the Thanksgiving one. In 2018, President Trump in the Thanksgiving turkey pardon situation, President Trump attacked Carrots the Turkey for refusing to concede that he'd lost the vote on the White House turkey pardon contest. And so we have a clip of Trump from back in 2018 saying, "This was a fair election. Unfortunately, Carrots refused to concede and demanded a recount." So that's funny to see that today. Don't you need a little humor? Now, one thing I was thinking of, do we want Trump hanging around, threatening to be the candidate, sucking all the oxygen out of the room, threatening to be the candidate in 2024? Will that keep other Republicans from getting into the game? So I'm concerned about that. And I put up a poll, but my poll doesn't give you all the options. My poll just said, Trump voters only, please. If you had to pick the GOP nominee right now, you got two choices, Trump or Tom Cotton. And I'm telling you, Tom Cotton is winning. Trump has 43%. Tom Cotton has 57%. Some people might be complaining that I only gave you two options, but as I said in my post title, my poll, my options, do your own poll if you don't like the constraints. You know, you have to limit the poll to get an interesting picture. I'm not doing a scientific poll. I'm just trying to get some thinking crystallized here. So I present Tom Cotton as a sort of perfect standard candidate, you know, someone who's educated in the right way, has the right kind of experience, is able to speak clearly, substantively, trenchantly on all of the topics. And then you've got Trump, who has his own wild ways. So it's kind of fun to watch Trump, or incredibly aggravating and insane, but I like the idea of Cotton. People keep making the joke, black people won't pick Cotton. I'm seeing that in the comments every time I bring up the subject of Tom Cotton. I don't really know who all the Republican candidates might be, but I just think Tom Cotton has the, and I haven't studied him in a great deal of depth, but he seems to be the type of candidate that I would like to see, someone who is highly normal in his presentation. Normal, but on a high level, a high normal character. That's my preference. I don't like too much of excitement from my politicians. Now here's an article in the Washington Post by Roxanne Roberts. This was really something. It's called Washington's Establishment Hopes a Biden Presidency Will Make Schmoozing Great Again. And I said, another way to say this is Washington's establishment hopes a Biden presidency will make Washington great for Washington again. And here's my quote from the article. For the last 4 years, the tone from the White House was contemptuous of Washington, dismissing the permanent establishment, the longtime politicians and former administration officials who call it home as the swamp or deep state. The social arbiters, traditionally respectful of a new administration, quickly found themselves between a Trump and a hard place, to invite or not to invite. Trump went to a handful of galas, but his attendance, or even the prospect of it, often brought controversy and protests. Without Trump, the White House Correspondents' Dinner, typically a night of mutual goodwill between the administration and the press that covers it, became an awkward defense of the First Amendment. Back to normal will mean more state dinners, a prestigious and glamorous way of reestablishing global ties. And it means that Washington events traditionally attended by the President and First Lady for the better part of 5 decades, the honors, the alfalfa dinner, the gridiron, Ford's Theater Gala, and the Correspondents' Dinner will likely return to their former glory. And I said, the columnist assumes what we like is insiders coming together in a mutual love fest with glamorous, prestigious parties and helping each other feel good about themselves. What's great for them is great for us. And isn't it kind of disgusting to be enthusing about gala socializing when we the people are told that we can't even do a humble Thanksgiving with our deplorable relatives? I'm happy to see the commentariat at WAPO resists. The top-rated comment is, Trump was corrupt and an idiot, but getting rid of D.C. power brokers is a good idea. this article praising the return of the Wealth Rules Club, including corrupt Wilbur Ross, is extremely tone-deaf. Second highest. This article is nauseating. While the country's falling apart, people are on the equivalent of breadlines, and a loser refuses to acknowledge it in the process is wrecking democracy. These pigs are fretting about how they can put out the best canapes and dish the best dirt. Leave this garbage for Washingtonian. Okay. Now, I got one more, and it's the one that I want to spend the most time on. I'm most interested in, because it's the art one. I find myself being especially drawn to the art topics these days, more so than politics. I like to talk about art. But, of course, this politics to this art. It's the art and politics subject. So this is from an article in the New York Times. Melania Trump on Friday announced that a work by the sculptor Isamu Noguchi would be installed in the White House Rose Garden, a gift to the National Collection that would be the first work by an Asian American artist to be included in it. The sculpture, Noguchi's 1962 floor frame, highlights the beautiful contributions of Asian American artists to the landscape of our country, Ms. Trump said in a statement. And I said, Noguchi is a highly respected sculptor, one of the greats, recognized for many decades. It's weird to see him talk about as if he's mostly a representative of a mass, Asian American artists with their contributions to the landscape. Anyway, I've been critical of so many public sculptures lately, so it's satisfying to see something completely aesthetically pleasing. And I like how utterly low to the ground and solidly stable it is. It would be hard to topple. Not that I think the statue topplers will ever get into the Rose Garden. The New York Times focuses not on the aesthetics of the sculpture, floor frame, but Noguchi's time in an internment camp in World War II. We are reminded of what Trump said. The Times tells us what Trump said in 2015 when he was asked about the U.S. government's internment policy in World War II. Trump said, I certainly hate the concept of it, but I would have had to be there at the time to give you a proper answer. Close quote. Isn't that a sober response from Trump? And the president who chose to adopt that policy was Franklin Roosevelt, the big hero of the Democrats. So here's Trump kind of giving FDR cover. What's up with that? I mean, he seems to have a lot of depth there. Of course, I hate the concept, but I would have had to have been there at the time to give you a proper answer. Or maybe that shows how awful Trump is, that he actually hates the idea but would do it, you know. And he sees himself as doing some things today that are somewhat like that. And I said, interestingly, Noguchi himself was not subject to the order that put Japanese Americans into camps. He didn't live on the West Coast, but in New York. He chose to spend time in one camp because he wanted to work on the design. And this is a quote from the Times article. Instead of a place defined by its barbed wire enclosures, he envisioned a school, community center, botanical garden, and even a miniature golf course in one blueprint. Close quote. That never happened, but imagine detention camps where you'd want to live. And here's a picture of floor frame. You can see it's very low to the ground and it's in two pieces and kind of angular in shape so that it looks like maybe the sculpture goes down into the floor and then emerges out of it. So the kind of illusion that it's a continuous piece that goes down into the floor or ground and then comes up out of it. And I went to the Noguchi website to see the picture, and then I saw this quote from the artist. He said, thinking of the floor, I made floor frame. I made many other pieces in relation to floor space at that time, but this seemed to best define the essentiality of floor, not as sculpture alone, but as part of the concept of floor. And I said, so it's all about the floor. but they're putting it in the garden. They're putting it outside, even though his discussion of it is about the essentiality of the floor, the concept of the floor. It's called floor frame. It's all about floor. That's an interior piece of work. To put it outside is to act like it's really ground frame. The essentiality of the ground, the concept of the ground. Is that the concept of the ground? Miss Melania Trump's statement informs us that the sculpture represents a tree and its roots. And the New York Times attributes that meaning to Noguchi. Such lazy and easily refuted propaganda. I could just as well say that the relocation of the floor sculpture to the garden symbolizes the relocation of Japanese Americans in World War II. I mean, you can say anything you want about what art means. You can make up all sorts of things. But it seems to me the artist himself said it was about the floor. The title is about the floor. So it's not about roots and trees and Asian Americans with their contributions to the landscape. It's about floor. He wanted to say something about the floor. Anyway, there's no floor below which we do not sink as we make up self-serving arguments. But I like the sculpture. I think it'll probably look just fine outside as it relates to the ground as opposed to the floor. And probably they'll put it on concrete and maybe a sort of a patio-like structure out in the rose garden will be just as floor-like as the indoor floor. Indoor floor. But I just wish, why can't people care more about getting things accurate and precise and to tell the truth? Why can't that be a stronger value? Why must people twist and lie and distort? Isn't there some, you know, I would have thought that truth and accuracy would be a much more powerful draw. But I'm not seeing that, and I don't expect to see it under the Biden administration any more than under the Trump administration. All I can do is just keep watching on a daily basis and pick out a few things to point out where we've gone astray or where I think you might look if you want to keep track of whether we're going astray. And that's really all I can do.